Welcome to another episode of Out of the Woodwork podcast, brought to you by Axminster Tools with me, Sean Evely. In this week's episode, we talk to designer, craftsman and maker William Hardy, founder of Studio Hardy. William's ethos in making lies in infusing art, design, engineering, architecture and craft to produce stunning pieces to fill spaces. He describes his work as innovative and playful, which is reflected in his love for designing playgrounds. His wealth of experience and skill has led to him to work for many notable clients, including the English Heritage, the National Trust, and the Royal Hashemite Court of Jordan. He recently found TV fame joining George Clark for Channel 4's Amazing Spaces programme. So, William, thank you very much for joining me.
Total pleasure, Sean.
Yeah, well, your work is really incredible, so I'm honoured to be talking to you, and thank you so much for coming on.
No, I'm sorry I can't be there in person, but I'm here at home. The workshop is so busy and so noisy, there was no chance of sort of doing a podcast from there.
yeah, I can imagine. So for the very few people that aren't aware of your work, can you give us a brief background on what you do and Studio Hardy?
Gosh, here we go. It's always a bit of a roller coaster, this. So I set up Studio Hardy as a sort of multidisciplinary practice. I wanted to fuse craft and making, carpentry, design, engineering, art, a bit of philosophy, and sort of alternative collaborative approaches. So I wanted to create a company where, rather than all of that was separated and nobody talked to each other, actually we threw everybody into the mix. We could kind of make or design anything on earth. And that's how sort of Studio Hardy came about.
Yeah, well, lots of people nowadays are specializing, but I think you can incorporate everything, which is quite unique. And some of the things, I'm not sure how someone goes from smaller projects like boxes to these large installations. Did you used to do smaller projects or were you big installations from the get-go?
No, I mean, I started making tiny things. Actually, as a kid, I was a really keen model maker. So making miniature plastic kit models. And yeah. Then that sort of, I suppose, grew from the miniature into just making bigger and bigger stuff. But yeah, it's one of the things, you know, the nuances of my work, but also the teams, is that we can work on really tiny, delicate little things like boxes right through to really quite big schemes, you know, almost landscape works and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So what training did you have in this field? Because lots of courses, like I said, are very specialist. So, but you seem to do a bit of everything. So did you go on multiple courses?
Yeah, I think that's something I really believe in. So, you know, quite often as a kid, you're sort of, you know, you go to school and you do a bit of everything. And then quite quickly, you're sort of funneled through the system, GCSEs or A-levels or apprenticeships, into doing kind of one thing. And that really, really bothered me because I was interested in so many different things. So my journey was, I was very lucky being a bit older than you, Sean. I actually could do, you know, quite a lot of carpentry at school. And one of the schools I went to had lathes and actually metalworking shop. You weren't allowed aged kind of 12 to get on panel saws, but you were allowed on a lathe and things like that. So that sort of spurred the interest. I also, from about the age of 13, just made my money by saying, yeah, I'll build a, you know, a shelf or whatever it would be. And sort of learned the very hard way. I then went on to study Art Foundation, and Art Foundation is the most wonderful course. I kind of almost recommend it for anybody because you're going to do theatre design, fine art painting, 3D design, photography, all these different things. And then I went on to study at Brighton University. They still do run a really cool course, which when I did it was called Wood, Metal, Ceramics and Plastics. And it's sort of split into two parts. There's a sort of design for technology, more like industrial design, and then a design for craft. And I obviously veered towards the craft. But it didn't stop there. All the other things I did, I mean, after that, I got very into permaculture and was working, doing some charitable work. And then I went to America and studied spiritual psychology. And it was about the age of kind of 25 where I started to thread all these interests together. So, you know, art, craft, design. And it really bothered me that you had to do one of those things. And I was like, but they're all utterly connected. So hence I sort of formed my own company doing that.
So what made you want to go to California? I think I read it was in California to do the spiritual psychology. Because that is a big, big leap, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it was a weird one. So I actually quit university, I think, in the second year, and then got into this permaculture work. Permaculture actually plays a huge part in the sort of principles by which I work. And ultimately, it's because it's that concept that everything's connected, that we live in a holistic, you can't separate things out.
Yeah.
So in the charitable work, we were holding festivals, teaching people ecological principles. And then with the money that we could raise at the festival, we would try and buy that bit of land and turn it into either a sort of forest garden or actually just leave it in perpetuity to the public or to wildlife. And realizing that we had about 500 people all with the same vision, and yet every time there were just problems with people. And I realized that, you know, emotionally, we're all sort of pushed and pulled and contorted by emotions. And I just didn't have the tools to work with people. And so that's really why I went, you know, I thought, okay, if I'm ever going to achieve anything, I'm going to need to be able to work with people and work out how to get people with a shared vision to, you know, deeply collaborate, get on, and almost be efficient. So that was the kind of motivation.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's helped a lot. Do you think that's a key part of your success?
Absolutely. I think, you know, as much as the stuff we make is interesting, I think the way we work as a company and collaborate with loads of people on all sorts of different projects, I think it's really important, actually. We've constantly tried to challenge, you know, I had a meeting about contracts yesterday and came out going, one approach is you defend your side of the contract and attack the other. And another one is, you know, actually, how can we give and share and, you know, come up with a situation that's just much more pleasant and actually works for everybody, you know, cooperation, collaboration. So, yeah, no, it plays a major part. As a student or younger, to say permaculture or spiritual psychology be a really good sort of thing to study for woodworking, I would have gone, you know, no. But with higher insight, everything everybody does in their lives actually plays some beautiful part in what they end up doing.
Okay. So after all your studying, you started Studio Hardy straight away, or did you work for someone else?
No. I was really fortunate. So quite early on, it was actually my tutor from sort of sixth form college, a brilliant sculptor and furniture maker called Alison Crowther, was in need of a new assistant. And I heard about this. I was actually living in Spain at the time. And I came back to England and became her assistant stroke apprentice for about 3 years. She makes the most exquisite, huge green oak pieces, which are shaped quite often really quite geometrically and then hand carved. So that was a brilliant introduction. Alison is very pragmatic and really organized and really focused. So to work with an artist furniture maker for 3 years, learn so many things about business, but also lots and lots of technique. That then led me on, because I was working Green Oak, I got really interested and started working with some absolutely brilliant timber framers. So for about four years, I worked for lots of fantastic timber framers. And that was my introduction to the sort of history of woodwork, to sort of basic engineering, and of course, suddenly working on much, much bigger projects.
Yeah.
And then I also worked with quite a lot of furniture makers, basically, you know, trying to put some money together. So, you know, I built kitchens and furniture in other people's workshops. And that was a real key in that the people that I worked for taught me so much, you know, in a kind of like a kind of apprenticeship way.
Yeah. And it's all the different jobs you did were doing something different. So you were collecting different skills all along the way. So you finally started your own company. What was your big break, would you say?
So the big break was quite dramatic. I got a call from an old friend saying, we need someone to design and build a playground in Amman for the royal family of Jordan, for their new palace. Okay. I was working on a medieval restoration of a barn, I think, at the time. And I went, which has always been my attitude to everything, yeah, of course. and that was the sort of learning curve like that. I suddenly had to pull together all of my sort of artistic techniques and ideas, you know, how I was going to do formal presentations, how I was going to show them a concept, how I was going to price this thing, how I was going to build a team, because I was working as a freelancer, so sole trader, how I was going to find a yard, how I was going to source all these timbers, how I was going to do the research of how, say, green oak would cope with going up to sort of 45 degrees.
Yeah.
I made a lot of mistakes. But one thing that I decided was that I really wanted this to be a great thing, and that even if in terms of effort, blood, sweat, tears, financially, it was a disaster for me, this was my chance to sort of make a mark. And it ended up not being a total disaster, actually being a really, really lovely project and something that I'm still very proud of. And it kind of forged the working method of how we do all our projects now.
Yeah. So from that first playground commission, playgrounds are quite a big part of your business.
Yeah. I mean, though we are quite eclectic and we do get involved in lots of things, play is becoming more and more center stage for us. And I think there's two parts to that. There's one, playgrounds. And then there's also, if there was another thread in our work, it's playfulness. So, you know, even our TV work or any of our sort of fun multifunctional furniture, it's all playful.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've worked for English Heritage particularly for many years, but also the National Trust, councils, schools. And we kind of specialise in, they're normally heritage sites. They're sites that you can't just put an off-the-shelf piece of play kit. You need to respond sensitively to the surroundings. I mean, it's brilliant. You know, if you work in architecture, you're working on sort of 5-year projects. If you're working in playgrounds, you're working, you know, that's shrunk down to a year or two. And, you know, we've done Baroque, we've done 17th century castles, we've done medieval, we've done Art Deco, sort of variation. Yeah. At the moment, working on a Victorian one. So, you know, all of that wonderful sort of craft detail, it is really fun to respond to.
I'm sure they're incredibly enjoyable to make, but how do you feel that the target audience who are using the product might not appreciate the work that's gone into it?
Well, I think they do. And I think it's really important in a digital age to actually spur an interest in making, in how something is assembled. And for example, we still use a lot of timber frame. And what's lovely about timber frame and some joinery is that you see how it's made. You can see the peg. You can kind of assemble it in your mind. And then, you know, they're also very tactile. Timber particularly is a very tactile material. You can use different species of timber, different sort of textures and colours and tones. And I think also kids respond really well to being given something quite grown up.
Yeah.
They bring the kind of wild, fantastic, colourful imagination. But, you know, we believe that kids quite like playing on, if you're allowed to, on roofs and scaffold and everything you're not allowed to play on.
Yeah.
So actually giving them something really quite grown up and considered,
yeah,
we find they respond really well to.
And probably seeing your pieces, how well they're made, and if there are exposed joints, they'll be learning and hopefully inspired to learn more about it and maybe take up crafting themselves.
Yeah, we really hope that. And I think also the, you know, adults, you know, you get a lot of grandparents taking their kids to these, you know, on a day out. And actually, they really enjoy it. You know, as a parent, you spend, I don't even want to imagine how long I've spent in the rain standing in playgrounds. So the difference between a really well considered space and just somewhere you don't want to be is really great. And I think the other thing we try and do with playgrounds is infuse a degree of sort of learning and interpretation. So you can learn, a lot of us learn a lot more through playing than we do through just reading something. So actually it's an opportunity to understand more about the sites or the history of a place through play.
Yeah. Is the favourite playground you've made the most challenging to make? Do you have one in particular?
Oh, it's really hard to know what my favourite one is. One we did really recently, which was definitely a real challenge to make. It's in the Cannons Park in Mitcham in South London. And it was a really cool project, actually, because we actually developed the designs with local children and the community. And in a sort of brainwave, eureka moment, where we started to look at the kids' sketches and go, what if we, you know, just took that sketch, a wobbly ladder with all of its rungs sort of,
yeah,
and just made it exactly as it is? How cool would that be? And what one of the real features of this playground came about, we did a lot of making stuff out of paper, trying different shapes and forms and trying to make play kits with scraps of paper. And we started to look at the way kids would scrumple up every drawing they didn't like. And we would flatten out the scrumple paper. And what we ended up making was a giant timber sort of scrumple paper structure that you can get in and under and over, and like the most complex kind of ramp structure. So,
wow.
I mean, it looks fantastic. It's a really unusual bit of play kit. It's, you know, it's quite challenging, but doesn't have prescribed use. There's a billion ways of playing with it.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, joinery, it was every angle, every bit of knowledge we've ever accumulated had to be used on it. We ended up, there was an amazing scene of six carpenters with this huge thing spread out in our workshop, with circular saws on tracks on what in one hand and laptops on the other, because it was so difficult to draw. The only way of doing it was giving everybody a three-dimensional model, because it was just so 3D.
So you do a lot of computer design. A project like that makes me think there must be some digital fabrication involved. Do you use CNCs in your work?
We do. But it sort of comes down to our manifesto. I mean, one of the questions we ask of anything that we're making is, what is the right way? What's the most sort of honest and true way of making something? And that sounds like a strange question, but to make anything, there are 100 different routes. And, you know, at Studio Hardy, one of the things we pride ourselves on is we get everybody together and we debate all of the different approaches to making something. And, you know, we're not adverse to digital technology, but we ask questions like, if that's really boring to make, then let's get it CNC'd. But if there's some fun in it, let's make it by hand. So in a way, it's just part of the skill of design and carpentry is reaching for the right tool. And so if that's going to be 50 hours of being on a router, definitely, you know, have it CNC'd. Yeah. But if it's going to be a bit more playful, then let's try and make it by hand.
Your point of making an item that suits a place, I think especially works when you're making an item for a historical site, making it in the way they would have made it. Do you still do work like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really interesting thing. I think, say, joinery, there's a kind of, we call it integrity, but it's picking the right way of doing something. And it's really hard to explain to somebody that, say, isn't a carpenter. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, I'm hoping you will get, you know what I'm on about.
Okay.
But it's like, well, it's like if you make something that looks fantastic, but you knew you didn't really make the joints strong enough. And it doesn't matter how polished the thing looks. You just know, oh, it's not quite right. So I think that's a real drive after whatever it's been, 20 years of making things. I don't like that feeling. I like to walk away from a project and go, I know that its foundations, I know that its soul is sort of true. And then on the other front, absolutely. I mean, we, you know, right down to there's a project we're hoping to work on soon where we'd like to, it's a kind of little pavilion with, you know, very Georgian moldings, quite complicated friezes and everything. And we were like, the quality you get by making shaping planes and actually doing it by hand rather than putting it through a spindle molder is so particular, it's so subtle, but it really has a different quality. It has a kind of different spirit. So that's an example of where we'll probably use a combination. We certainly won't go down the CNC, but we will use some spindle molders. And then we'll actually make quite a few scratch planes to actually do, you know, the final detailing on those moldings.
Out of the Woodwork is brought to you by Axminster Tools. Nobody is more passionate or knowledgeable about woodworking than us. A market leader in mail order tools and the machinery industry, we offer a friendly and personal service to thousands of woodworkers all around the world. Whether you're a trade professional, business owner, education leader, amateur DIYer, or a hobby enthusiast, we share your passion. Discover more about Axminster Tools. Visit www.axminstertools.com. So, now changing the conversation from Studio Hardy, TV is a big part of your life. What I'd like to know is how that all started and how you got into TV.
Yeah, yeah, another sort of page in the book. Most of my life has been about saying yes before really thinking about it. but it's also people, you know, people never underestimate just talking to people about what you do. So as a very young age, even when I'd only made five things, I would carry a picture of those five things and I'd show it to anybody. Maybe it was meeting teachers or even, you know, my parents' friends. I'd just show them what I'd done. And that led to people having conversations. Oh, we met this interesting guy. He did this. And that's, you know, how everything grew. So anyway, TV was very like that. There's a fantastic vintage shirt maker in Lewis.
Okay.
And she was approached by the person that sort of came up with Amazing Spaces and said, oh, we're doing this quirky new show about small and interesting, you know, homemade spaces. Do you know anybody locally that, you know, does that sort of thing? And of course the shirt maker went, oh, you've got to go and see William. He does all these wacky, strange conversions and playgrounds and oddball things. And so they came and visited me. And originally the idea was we would just help George build the caravan, the first series of Amazing Spaces. And then it kind of worked, the synergy between me and George. We are so different and yet we get on so well.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, I can sort of string a sentence together, though it's normally, you know, back to front, meant that they just got me more and more involved. And that gradually led from just a sort of sidekick carpentry role into more of a presenter role.
Yeah. So you, for people that don't know, you visit spaces on the show, some incredible spaces, but you also make some of your own. So what was the most impressive place you visited?
Okay, that is really hard because over 10, I think it's been, yes, we've done 10 seasons and, you know, I don't know how many visits that is, but in the many hundreds. Yeah. I've got to say that the one, oh, it's going to be a real split here, so I'm going to have to do two. Sorry, break the rules.
That's fine.
I visited Heatherwick's Maggie Centre in Leeds in the last season. That is one of the most astonishing builds I've ever seen. It's kind of a wonderful glue lamb, you know, obviously timber structure. Kind of, it's like being inside a mushroom or a kind of futuristic bio-eco space. And the whole Maggie's philosophy, which is incredible, the whole design code, is that the materials and the tones and the design of the space needs to be both sort of intimate but also shared and open, and every single cup or plate or piece of furniture needs to be handmade. So the sort of sense of quality and craft and well-being was just astonishing. That mixed with unbelievably sort of innovative techniques and design. And then the other one I saw was Grace and Perry's House for Essex, which is, again, there's a theme here. They're both kind of handmade, crafted structures. So Grayson had all these tiles that tell a story, that bespoke tiles that clad the building, and wonderful kind of copper roofs and shapes. And it's pretty out there and wacky and loud. It's a piece of art and architecture fused. I guess it's the fact that I like that both those designers, artists, have just broken the rules and merged loads of different ways of looking at things, done things that you're not kind of supposed to do,
yeah,
and just shown how incredible that can be.
Yeah. So the pieces you've made on the show, I'm sure you've got your favourites. One of my favourites is the rotating room. Now, I can only imagine there must have been a lot of challenges. Did anything go wrong? Were you not able to achieve something that you wanted to add in?
I mean, what didn't go wrong? those kind of projects on the kind of budgets and timescales that you have are just, they are madness.
Yeah.
But the stairs were a real challenge, and I'm not sure they ever, you know, really properly worked. But going right back to the beginning, you know, we designed that entire structure to be made of metal, and it was going to be a metal structure. It seemed the obvious thing to do. And it was actually a sort of last minute thought of just like, actually, couldn't we do this in timber? I mean, we understand timber. Timber's so much easier to screw into.
Yeah.
Those sort of mega challenges, if we'd gone down the metal route, I think it would have been a total catastrophe. But what else happened? There were so many things. The electrics were really complicated. Trying to sync, you know, you press a button on the wall and you want your building to rotate exactly to the floor you want it to.
Yeah.
And that was really hard. We kept on it was run on mobility scooter wheels.
Yeah.
And I think we went through rather a lot of those. We would blow the motors just all the time.
Yeah. So another build you did was the flat that converted into the garden.
Yeah.
Which so many people would want that. Has anyone ever contacted you from the show wanting a similar piece being made for themselves?
Not yet, but
I'm really surprised.
It is interesting what, you know, how the show kind of the calls we get are quite out there. I mean, I think that was a really interesting project, and the two you've picked out are interesting because they're more like prototypes. They're more like saying, okay, this might not be the exact solution, but let's unpack this. Let's rethink how we live, and in a kind of playful way, and see what clues yeah. there are. And I think, you know, I'd never recommend that people live in rotating homes, having been through that experiment. However, I think some of the thought process involved and some of the rethinking is really useful. And I think, I hope the same with the garden room space, you know, the idea of creating views, the idea that actually you can grow edible plants indoors, the idea that you can bring more nature into your home. I mean, probably the most practical thing of that project was the idea of a winter garden. So if you genuinely don't have a you know, a balcony or a garden or a yard or any of those things, you know, almost sort of taking your front window and then creating a new screen and maybe opening the glass and just letting that be your balcony, you know, you sacrifice a little bit of your home, but it's still your home. And I think, you know, yeah. in terms of health and well-being, that's a really wise move.
Well, greenery is so important. People probably feel a lot better with it in where they're living. So that's why everyone has plant pots. So I think it's a very good idea, you know, even if you don't have space for a balcony.
I mean, I think the most amazing thing with that project is no plants were harmed during the making, which that is a miracle in itself, you know, with people up ladders at the last minute, people painting, finishing, fixing, plugs yeah. coming in, people doing the last of the plumbing and the electrics. Yeah,
I can totally see that the way we're going, because I'm seeing more and more multifunctional furniture, you know, beds coming out the wall, desks flipping down because, you know, people's spaces are getting smaller. And I've seen that in furniture. I haven't seen it in, you know, the plant and the garden space. So I can see pull-out gardens being a thing. So I think you're onto something. I'm not sure if you can patent that idea or anything.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? I think we really, really value outdoor space. And actually, a lot of British homes are all about the relationship with indoors, outdoors. We want big glazed things that open. We want to be bringing the outside in as much as possible. We want to be outside because of the weather here. Any minute chance of being outside, we want to maximize it. So I think yeah. There's a really deep need to connect with nature, and it's really difficult. So I thought it was a great challenge. You know, somebody that's living in an inner city flat, how can they achieve this? And I hope we gave some clues.
Yeah, you definitely did. So with all these projects, like the two I've just mentioned, they're huge, and you do most of your work seems to be larger installations. Now, one thing I was interested in, because a lot of woodworkers are making smaller freestanding pieces of furniture. So, and we find that quite scary, delivering that and sending it off to a courier and hoping it gets there safely. How do you send off these pieces? What is the delivery process like? And I'm hoping there's not, but has there ever been a nightmare situation where something didn't arrive the way you sent it?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
A lockdown special. We built an entire set of cabins for a winery in Sussex, and one of the cabins was, they weighed about 8 tons, and we would build a sledge outside the workshop. No, so like a stage, and we would wheel out the, you know, sort of berth these structures out of the workshop with about, you know, 30 mil tolerance either side of the doors, and then a crane would come, or a huge hi-ab, and pick them up and sort of then extract them the rest of the way out the workshop, put them on the lorries. We do about 3 or 4 at a time, and then this is all at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and then they would be sent off to site, and we'd all grab our kit and go off to site to then sort of land these prefabricated structures, and one of them hit a tree.
The lorry hit the tree?
Hit the tree, yeah. So the cabin was pretty much written off. I mean, you know, it had such a big smash. And the problem with the building is all of the layering, you know, you've got to go right back. Is the plumbing okay? Is the electrics okay? Is the structure okay? Is the insulation, all of those layers? So that was a real... That's probably the worst thing that's ever happened. We have transported some really, I mean, that rotating home, there was only 2 trailers in the country that could actually take that because it was so big. It was a huge thing. And it went from our workshop to Pinewood. That's an example where, okay, I'm going to clear something up once and for all. Okay. We didn't measure it wrong. The idea was that it could be deassembled. The big rotating thing and the feet it sat on could be disassembled. But at the last minute, you know, 2 days before we were going to leave, it was like, we could either take this whole thing apart and then take it outside and put it back together again, or we could just sort of cut, you know, 100 mil out of the brickwork of our workshop and just make the entrance bigger. So, we went for the latter. It was a sensible move, though I think wow. George was still say, oh, you measured it wrong.
Wow. So these projects, like the rotating room and all these crazy designs you've come up with, can you talk about your design process and, the creative process in general?
Yeah, I mean, that's really, really important to us, that creative journey. So we have a lot of different processes, and I think it goes back to that picking the right tool for the job. And I think with experience, you know, sometimes you need to work with words and thought and philosophy and ideas for a project. Sometimes you need to pick up a pencil. Sometimes you need to kind of literally play with something like paper or clay. And sometimes you need to go straight to a computer and work, you know, model something. So we've always allowed ourselves a kind of free thinking, you know, a kind of absolute sky's the limit brainstorm early on. Don't worry about practical. Don't worry about cost. Don't worry about anything. Like, what journey can we take this item or thing on? And that goes, I do the same for, like, if I was designing a chair, I would start with drawing. So I take lots and lots of paper. I'll get a pencil and I'll just draw chair after chair after chair after chair. And each one will grow. And then if I get stuck, I'll just start drawing shapes. And then that will trigger another idea. And so I'm very inefficient. What I'll do is I'll create literally maybe 200 designs for one object. But I have to go on that journey. I have to know that whatever I come up with, I've explored every other avenue.
Yeah.
So what we do is we do that sort of big, wide scattering. We work more and more with mind maps. We put all these massive, huge walls of images and ideas, and the sort of links go further and further and further out. When we feel like we've done that enough, we've really explored every connection with this thing, we then draw it back in and we look at what we've learned in that process. And from that gradually comes out some of the sort of main themes and main ideas. But I'm a really big believer that, and it's something that fascinates me, is design is a sort of beautiful balance of art and science. So I don't believe in waiting for inspiration. I believe you just, almost a scientific method, you know, aim, apparatus, you know, let's just start experimenting. And at some point in every project, just that moment of revelation comes where you just go,
yeah,
ah, that's it. And just everything sort of links together. And it's not something you can kind of force. I've got a method by which I get there, and it always happens. There is eternally the fear that one day that spark of inspiration just won't come.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're working very late at night and going, I've got a presentation tomorrow and I don't think I've got it yet. But it sort of always comes. And that's the kind of magic of design, I think.
Yeah. You said your favorite types of builds are when the clients don't actually know what they want and they're a bit confused themselves. Has there ever been a brief you haven't been able to meet?
Ooh, that's a really good question. No, I mean, what I think we're learning is that often clients don't know what they want. And so it's a very strange thing. And that goes for big corporate clients as well. You know, almost the first stage is really trying to understand what they want and what they need and almost rewriting the brief for the clients. Because quite often people are asking for one thing, but actually when you dive into it, they actually need something else. I think we've always met the brief. And I do agree. You know, one of the things that gets me excited about a project is when I do not know what it's going to look like at all. You know, when they say, we'd like you to design this like a garden studio flat or a, you know, certain Baroque playground. And you just go, I actually don't know what that looks like. I don't know what that's going to be like. And that's a wonderful journey to embark on. And it's sort of more exciting than instantly having an image of what you want to create.
Yeah, I imagine with that process, it normally turns out a lot better than you were expecting.
Yeah, I think so. And also it's a journey with the clients, which is really exciting. You go on this voyage of discovery. And I mean, I think so many projects end up so different from what anybody imagined they'd be. They quite often go in quite different directions. But because of real, you know, deep consideration, I'm still fascinated by whether there's anything we've not been able to deliver on. There are projects, the longest ones we've ever worked on are 8 years.
Wow.
I'm certainly on a project at the moment that's in its fourth year. So they're long, and we're still kind of at concept phase. So they're
a physical item in the workshop?
Not yet. We're still we're about to move from concept and design development into technical design. So we're about to move into workshop drawings after 4 years.
Is there ever a worry that you're putting all this time and investment in and suddenly the client might pull out because, you know, you haven't actually started making it?
Yeah, no, that is a very tricky thing. And, you know, I think we've been very lucky, and I think both lucky, but also we're selective with our clients. And we really try and install this kind of duty of care that we're in this together. We really want this to work for you. In return, you have to make sure it works for us. And so actually, we've always been all right, actually. COVID obviously caused all sorts of problems. Loads of projects did collapse. We tender for loads of projects, so the bigger projects, and you might put in a huge amount of work for a project that you don't even get an interview for. So that's always a roller coaster. It's a real high when you win a project, and it's a pretty big low when you've put 3 weeks of late nights into proposing something, and the client just goes, no, we won't even invite you to interview.
Wow. Yeah. So do you rather, when a client has a bit of a brief, so let's say the playground you're doing at the moment with the Victorian design, or do you like it when you have complete design freedom? Do you prefer a bit of direction or no direction?
I think I'm ultimately more of a designer, that I want the freedom to explore that in any way I'm allowed.
Yeah.
But I need something. But that can be the space, that can be the place. So often the brief might be as simple as, we need a playground in this site, and then we'll draw out what that playground should be. And so the inspiration very much comes from the landscape and the surroundings. So, I think you need a little bit of a constraint. You know, if it's too open, I do get quite lost. You know, occasionally I'll sit down and go, right, I'm just going to design something. And 16 pages later, I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. I've drawn loads of stuff, but I have no idea. I need to give myself a brief.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of woodworkers are in the same page. But also, a lot of woodworkers hope for inspiration, but your idea of mapping everything out and having a methodical method, I think a lot of people can learn from that and try and find something that works for them. Because you said it never fails and something always comes. So that's a really good tip.
I think that's really important. And, you know, to come up with an idea, say it's a wardrobe or a chair or a building, you need to find a tool that allows you to explore. Now, for me, that's sketching, or perhaps modeling on the computer. Other people, you know, really don't feel comfortable sketching, so you've got to find another way of doing it. And sometimes that can actually be going and looking for inspiration. You know, I used to go to places like the V&A Museum just to look at all the furniture, look at all those details. Actually, there's an auction down the road in Lewis that I go to every week, and I rarely buy anything. I'm just looking at, every week I see 400 bits of furniture, pieces of furniture from the last 300 years. And I'm just sort of absorbing all these details, all these ideas. Sometimes it's just the playful way a sort of secretaire opens, or a secret drawer, or just a really nice chamfer or something like that. So, I think everybody needs to find the mechanism by which they can create and come up with an idea.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for someone trying to find inspiration, not necessarily just sitting down and waiting for it to come? Any places they can go or things they can do?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of books, personally. So actually going to libraries, go to the design or architecture section and have a look. And one thing I would say is that cross-disciplinary thing. So if you're a carpenter, don't go to the carpentry section of a library. Go to the architecture section, or go to the art section, or go to the sculpture section. And I think actually museums are really good just to look at real objects. I think, you know, personally, nature's a huge inspiration. And another trick that is really important is don't look too much at other people's interpretation. So say somebody designs a snail chair that's been inspired by a snail shell.
Yeah.
Don't sort of go and endlessly look at other people's furniture that's copied or borrowed from nature. go back to nature itself and see what forms, what things will inspire you. And that becomes a much sort of rawer source and will lead to a much more sort of original idea.
Yeah, that's really good advice. So you mentioned being on the TV show is inspiring a lot of people when people come up to you and saying, you're the reason my husband has taken over the garage. And what saddens me is a lot of creative subjects are being taken out of schools at the moment. What do you think can be done to encourage the youth to start making again, or not necessarily the youth, just people making in general? Because I think craft shows like The Repair Shop, like Amazing Spaces, are, you know, making people more aware of craft. But is there anything else you think that can be done to bring creative subjects back into schools and make people make again?
Yeah, I mean, I totally, you know, I started by saying half the inspiration was being given access to tools at school, you know, and I think it's really, really important that creative and making skills are explored at schools. You know, it's great that schools have, say, laser cutters and even CNC machines, but it is that hands-on. It's the direct playing with a material that almost the definition of craft, where you play with something and you learn about it. We have to remember that one half of the world, and I definitely fall in this camp, learn through applied learning. So if you tell me, you know, at school, if someone said, do this mathematical sum based on trigonometry, I didn't really understand it and I wouldn't learn it. Now, if someone said, we want you to build us a pyramid, here's the materials, I would start to try and do it. And I'd get to a point where I go, you know what, this isn't working. I need to know what the distance of that in relation to that should be. And at that point, I would go to a teacher and say, is there some sort of mathematical way of learning, you know, of building this pyramid? And I would have learnt it for life. So I would actually go further. I would say that the sort of making and that playful, explorative, applied way of learning stuff needs to be in all stages of schools and our development. And then on the other front, I think the future is makerspaces. I'm a really big fan of, you know, community makerspaces. So not everybody can obviously afford to have a garden shed full of tools. I mean, they should, you know, everybody should have a garden shed full of tools, but they can't.
Yeah.
So what about shared spaces where even for professionals, not everybody needs a huge 3 meter panel saw. That's a huge thing to have, but everybody needs access to some of that kit. So if we can set up more and more community maker spaces where you get access to technicians, you can go in and it can be somebody wanting to repair something. It can be a child saying, I really want to make this thing, but I don't know how, and do those classes. So, you know, where it's really important to bring making, design and craft, I think, even into the curriculum or more firmly into the curriculum, there are other ways we can take it into our hands. So, you know, we run workshops in our hometown where there was one actually that a friend ran recently. It was called Wonky Toys. And it's just that free form. Here's a load of stuff. Here's a drill. Here's some screws. Just go and play. And people get really into it. They're so rewarding to make something and stand back and go, wow, I just made that. Though it is critical that design and making and the sort of hands-on is taught in schools and part of the curriculum, I think there's more we can do. We could have open access workshops. Actually, workshops and companies can open their doors, maybe just run something once a month, you know, invite people in to make something, learn something. Because there is nothing like making something, sort of standing back, looking at it and just going, I made that. That is such a special thing. And very particularly in a digital age, I think actually using your hands and your brain and your eyes to form something real is really special.
Yeah, especially beginners, after they leave one of these courses, the best bit is them taking whatever they made home and then probably trying to work out how they're going to do the same at home. And then they're going to start building up their tool collection. I find it a really good idea when you mentioned about, you know, the mass and the pyramid, making other subjects teach in a different way. So you don't necessarily need a design technology course, even though I'd love one. But that's a good point. In different lessons in science, don't just give them an equation. Have a fun way of working it out instead. That can be quite interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually that's really the sort of foundation of Studio Hardy is everything I learned at school or didn't learn at school, I now deal with. So history, philosophy, maths, you know, English, writing, geography, all the science subjects, you know, there are things to learn, like the method, the scientific method. They all play a part in my world now. And at school, they're all separated. But actually, you can't separate them. They're all connected. And it may be that your route to interest in history is through, say, making. It's maybe not learning which king was in what order, but you look at a building and go, wow, that building's different from that building. Well, I wonder what sort of thought process. And then you find out that the reason they started to use this was because of a scientific innovation or because there was a huge fire and there weren't any more of that kind of tree. You know, it's really interesting.
Yeah. And also there's sort of more maker events being popping up all around the place, like Maker Central. I think that's really encouraging the youth to get making, especially if they don't have access to that in schools. Have you gone to any of these make events?
Not in recent years. I've been kind of locked away.
Yeah,
the last few years.
You'll probably be swarmed, to be honest.
Yeah, I haven't been for years, but I do really enjoy. I mean, I really enjoy a lot of the Craft Council stuff too, going to those exhibitions where you just see all the incredible fusion of art and making. No, I really enjoy that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, I think we're getting to the hour, so I don't want to keep you from your work. And I really enjoyed chatting to you, William, and I hope you enjoyed it too.
Yeah, it's really nice to see you again, Sean, actually. And, you know, some really good questions. I think I'll be thinking about this for the rest of the day.
Yeah, well, I think the listeners will definitely benefit. You did part a lot of wisdom on us, so thank you.
Great, my pleasure.
Join us again next time for another episode of Out of the Woodwork. For more episodes, to listen and subscribe, search for Out of the Woodwork on all major podcast sites, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. For more woodworking project guides, demos, tools, reviews, and more, visit www.axminstertools.com.